Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Gottfried's Straight No Chaser. Well, this evening I'm going to do a little housekeeping and then I'm going to introduce my special guest. And I'm very excited about this guest because I've known him for a while, but he's known my husband even longer. But before I get to that, let me just give you some of the information that you need. If you want to call in and ask a question or a comment, then you need to call 516-453-6063. If you want to see any back episodes or hear this again, I should say hear any back episodes, then you go to blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, and the number 2. We will do an after-show afterthoughts, and I put that on YouTube, and you can subscribe to that. That way, everything that comes on my channel, you'll get to it. Or you can go to Godly Entertainment on Facebook, and that happens about an hour after we finish this. Now, to my guests, and welcoming all those callers that are coming in. Good evening, Kwame S. Salter. Well, let me start. I think of how he knows my husband, Carl E. Lee. Kwame was an undergrad at Whitewater University of Wisconsin, but at grad school, he went to Madison, and that's when he met Carl Lee. They were both involved in the Afro-American Center there. And then later on, both of them became corporate, I think I call them corporate giants, corporate executives. But some of the things that I want to talk to Mr. Kwame S. Salter tonight will be about family. Kwame is the son of Mr. Samuel L. Salter and the diva, Ms. Reva Salter. He's the brother of the late George and Gracie. He's the father of Carrie, Kevin, Matthew, and Lauren. He's the husband of the Queen, Phyllis Harris Salter. I think I've gotten that right. He's the grandfather of 5. He's an author of 2 books, Striving While Black and Black Over White, Being the Boss, which I think refers to the position that he held at Oscar Mayer, which eventually turned into Kraft Foods, as Executive Vice President of Human Resources there. And then he's the CEO of Salter Consultant Group, LCC. He was a professor at Concordia University. He attributed to the Wednesday Journal at Oak Park. Oh, I could go on and on and on, but I want you to see how wonderfully qualified my friend Kwame S. Salter is to talk about the corporate world and then to talk about his connection to the artistic world. And so with no further ado, I'd like to introduce you to King. I call him that. Kwame S. Salter. Good evening.
Good evening, Queen. Thank you for a wonderful introduction.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's well deserved. I want to talk about a little bit. I talked about family, then business and college, but I want to start with family, your mother and father, who I did not get a chance to meet your father, but your mother, who I love dearly.
And you.
Excuse me? Sorry?
And she loved you as much as you.
Thank you. Her love and reading about it, her love for poetry, how did that, I would receive cards from her and they were always well-versed. They were, you could tell that she picked something very special. It didn't come out of a box and it just wrote something. She always had a special message. How did that influence you in your childhood? And tell me about her a little bit and her influence and education and all those things.
Well, what's interesting is that my mother and father in the 1930s met as undergraduates at Southern University, right outside of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in a little village called Scottsville. And my mother and father were both students. So my children are third generation college students.
Mm-hmm.
My mother always enjoyed language. She enjoyed reading, and it was passed on to me. My father mm-hmm. also was a ferocious reader. So I would get up in the middle of the night, as one is wont to do, to use the bathroom, and be 1 o'clock, and my father would be sitting on a couch with a lamp reading a book. And I'd just shuffle back to the bed because, you know, I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, what's that interesting? And, you know, at 1 o'clock you're reading. But my mother, as you pointed out, couldn't stand pre-printed greeting cards. She felt that anything you sent to a person should come from you. So she used to write poetry, and I still have some of her poetry, that she would send out. But any card she sent was directed and targeted to the individual, and her words were reflective of her relationship with that individual. So
I felt that, I felt that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But what happened with me was that you grow up in this environment of people who love language, who love writing, who love authentic relationships. That becomes almost axiomatic in your life. That's what you begin to do. Because that's what you are exposed to, and that's how you interface and interact with your parents. And then you take that out on the road, so to speak, into real life, and you realize that these things are very important attributes in order to get along with people. My mother used to say that manners eliminates most of the hassles in life, just good manners. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Manners. And so I was taught that very early on. And one of the things that I loved about Maya Angelou was that she was able to crystallize all of these experiences into little phrases that we quote now.
Yes.
For example, one of the things she said that reflected very obviously around my mother was, people will forget what you said, but they'll never forget how you made them feel. And my mother was very, very focused not making people feel bad. I told you the story that we were never allowed to call a person ugly. We could not use the word ugly. I think we've had that discussion. And
yes, we have.
I didn't know why she'd say it. You know, I'd say, well, you know, Mr. Spencer, she'd say, he is not easy to look at, but he's not ugly. I go, wow, okay. But we can never use certain words. We could not use put-down words on people. We never call names. And that
now,
was a rule in the house.
Taking that one step more into how you started to work with people in college and then on into your corporate career, how do you think that kind of being that specific about the imagery really influenced how you impacted the employees, and you had hundreds of them, if not thousands,
yeah,
underneath you, who looked to you, I believe, for a lot of answers. How did that work within your job description? How did you translate that?
Well, you know, I never tried to be anything other than who I was. Some people try to be the title that they hold. You know, I'm a VP, I'm a senior VP, I'm an EVP. No, I'm a person. I have a responsibility and a role, and all that title does is describe what my role expectation is. I tried to treat people as human beings. I tried to meet them where they were at. I tried to talk to them not as subordinates or inferior people, but as people who I needed to help me get to where I wanted to go. I would always use the old Sonny Rollins, who was a great saxophonist. He's still alive. But he would say, you know, if I appear taller, that's only because I'm riding on the shoulders of people who carried me this far. So I always let people know that I needed them more than they needed me. And the other aspect of it was I never got caught up in name calling. My kids will tell you, you never heard me disparage gay people, white people, any people. I don't use those terms. I don't try to interact with race. I try to interact with individuals in a group. I don't paint you with one broad brush stroke. I say, no, you're an individual. Let's talk. I'll give you an example. People would say, Kwame, why do you let people just walk up to you in the hallway and talk to you? And you know, they just want FaceTime. They're just trying to impress you. I said, sometimes they're trying to share something with me. So I don't know what their agenda is until they start talking, so I have to listen. And a lot of the executives would avoid people because they'd say they're wasting my time. Well, you can spend an hour trying to avoid somebody or 5 minutes listening. 5 minutes listening, you don't have to avoid them. They feel good about you listening to them. I just want to be another human being connecting with another human being.
Go on. I'll get there. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
My basic premise is this, and it's something I from my reading. People think that we're human beings having a spiritual experience. I think, and I believe, as the seers have written, that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. So for me, spirituality is very important. How I make you feel. I want you to feel the way you should feel as a creature of God, as somebody that's been created. You are a reflection of the universe. You have the unlimited potential, and I want to tap that. I want to unleash your potential. And
now,
I get something out of it.
Using all of those elements, how do you think that progressed not only in your job description, but as you know, when I ask people to come on this program, I'm thinking not only about what they did for a living, and usually people are very successful in what they did, but the next footprint, your footprint that you're leaving. What is the footprint? How did you utilize that to go beyond what the job description is, beyond what was expected, what was corporately expected of you? What was your thought process there? How can, you know, what led you to Kwame Salter Consultant Group, LCC? What led you to the artistic influence of Kara and Carrie and Kevin and Matthew and Lauren, who is an excellent singer, but who is now getting her, is it her master's? Is it her doctorate? I don't know which
her
one it is. Her master's?
Yeah, forensic anthropology at NYU.
Exactly. Now,
yeah.
But she's influenced, though, because the discipline that she's, you know, she has as a singer is then applied to all of that classwork. So how did you convey that? Not only to the people that you work with, but what artistically in your life? And I'm always trying to make that connection because the arts are always the first thing that people want to cut out our lives. And I always want people to understand how important it is that it formulates our lives. So I want to know some of the stories, some of the connections that you have. You know, how did, you know, what film or what moment, something that you passed on to that generation and that you've passed on to your 5 grandchildren that they...
Well, I have 6 grandchildren. Remember Braylon, Matthew's little girl, gives me 6.
Okay. All right. Yes. I've got number 1, 6. Oh, don't let me forget Matthew's child. Okay, please. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, so what happened is that I grew up in a household of music. My parents always had the music with the record player. And I also grew up because my mother liked art pictures. You remember she had your official picture that you signed framed in her apartment, in her house.
Yeah.
She always had it. Well, my kids got exposed to reggae, R&B, good country, Western, just music. Because for me, music is a universal language. It's like the reggae. I remember a good friend of mine who is a musician. I was saying, why is this reggae so addictive? He said, because the beat is the heartbeat. If you listen to reggae, it's your heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And so it ties into that. So my kids were exposed to artwork. They were exposed to music. They were exposed to theater because, you know, Phyllis is a big theater goer. And so, you know, we in New York, we would see Phantom of the Opera. We would see all the plays whenever we get to New York and we got a chance. So they've been exposed to the arts. And everybody who is alert can, if they think about it, they can put together a curated soundtrack of their life because there's music that affects us. I remember growing up as a teenager, and I was really influenced by Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions because there was a certain activism in their song. People mm-hmm. get ready, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our music in the 60s and the 70s reinforced our social activism. We didn't talk about, oh, she's got a big booty. Oh, she's this. Oh, he's that. They talked about the condition that we found ourselves in, and they gave us hope. And they gave us desire to achieve something greater. They were not promulgated and promoted as I'm rich and you're not. You know, today's celebrities, the whole thing is I got everything, you have nothing. Keep paying me and enjoy me while you suffer. No, back in the day, if you think about the arts, even though men were not ideally compatible with women all the time, but the songs always acknowledge the beauty and the effectiveness of having a relationship with a woman and how beautiful women are.
Especially Curtis Mayfield. Curtis Mayfield was really very good at that. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Well, you think about some of the songs, some of the R&B songs. You think about, for example, you think about The Spinners. You think about The Devil. Mm-hmm. These were songs. These were odes to women. They were beautiful songs. And mm-hmm. I think to a certain degree, it showed the respect and the appreciation. You think about the fact that black men like Smokey Robinson, as a homage to their mother, they sing in a falsetto voice. They sound like the mother when the mother got excited and upset. She'd go mm-hmm. to this high register. You think there's only one white group I know who did that well, and that was the Bee Gees, the falsetto.
Mm-hmm.
You think about that. That's how it influenced us. Here's Smokey Robinson, probably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, poet to ever write songs.
Yes.
And there he is, and he's singing in a tone, in a register that is a homage to his mother. Okay? That's how art influences.
Now, mm-hmm. given that an influence in your family, how did you translate that and transform that into your corporate relationships with people? Because you were in charge of thousands of people. I mean, it was...
Well, my function, the global supply chain, there were 96,000 craft employees worldwide. 66,000 of them were part of the global supply chain. So we had 2/3 of the employees.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you, the real challenge is when we went global and you see these culture clashes in terms of how Europeans think, how we think. But the one universal thing you had was music. I don't care whether you were from Finland or whether you were from Frankfurt, Kentucky. You could relate to certain music, whether it's Frank Sinatra, whether it's Bob Marley. You could relate to it. You could have a basis for conversation, at least. So what began to happen with me was that, for example, I had a meeting with my group once in San Francisco, and I bought them each a CD of the Beatles, Number Ones. I don't know if you've ever heard that album. It's a great album. It's all the number one hits of the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a compilation.
They were wondering,
yeah.
Why would mm-hmm. you do this? I was saying, the Beatles are like an organization, a team. And here's what happens when a team gets on the same page. Here's what they produce, number one hits. And if you think about the Beatles, every song the Beatles did, there's a blues riff in it. There's a blues riff. Just listen carefully. There's always... George Harrison's going to hit a blues riff at some point, okay? So mm-hmm. I was saying, you know, you got individual people with personalities that are different, but they come together around this love of artistic expression. This is what I loved about them. So I would always use music. I would give music out to people. I would use music as examples. I was influenced, for example, by the poetry of Conte Cullen, the Harlem Renaissance. You remember his poem, Incident? While traveling in old Baltimore, it goes like this. While traveling in old Baltimore, heart filled, head filled with glee, I saw a young Baltimorean looking straight at me. I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger. I tried to smile. He stuck out his tongue and called me nigger. All the time I was in Baltimore from May until December. That's all that I remember. That was from Conte Cullen. Claude McKay, If We Must Die. So all of this, the poet, the artist, you artists are like out there seeing things before we see them. You are able to take the elements that we see in our lives and put them together into a holistic picture and make a song out of it, make a play out of it, a drawing out of it. But you're telling us, here's what you're saying. We can take what you're saying and show you what you're saying, and you can listen, because life is so demanding. You don't have time to sit back and listen to this as art. But the artist says it is art. There's a change is going to come. Sam Cooke. Change is going to come. Oh, what a powerful song. I mean, what he's saying to people at a point in our experience as black people when things were just so awfully negative, he comes out with the song. A change is going to come.
Now, let me ask you this then. Given all of those elements that are positive, what happens, and we talked recently, and you sent me an article just yesterday about Silicon Valley, what happens when that kind of impact of the arts, when diversity then is void in a corporate structure, when you encounter a situation where you have to apply the elements of genuine diversity, not the cosmetic kind, not the ones where people put out a statement or they do something cosmetic that's like a little bandage. What elements do you apply then, and do you incorporate some of the arts in that elements? And again, we're almost halfway through our hour, see, so there we go again. But go ahead and talk about that. I think it's very important for people to understand how much of the arts are in the corporate structure that we experience, and the devoid of diversity, and how that affects us also, and we have to be aware of that. Go and expound upon that for me, please, Kwame.
In terms of how I use art in the corporate environment?
Yes. Especially, when it was devoid of diversity, how you inserted the diversity within it. And we've talked hour about hour and hour about diversities in certain situations. There are certain situations where, you saw that there was an unevenness.
Example, every year, we have the Black History Month in February. Mm-hmm. And Ken Burns, the great documentarian, said once, I was at a speech he gave, and he said, we have February, which is the shortest and the coldest month to celebrate Black History Month. Black History is not a monthly thing. It's an ongoing thing.
Yes.
So we would have these events for Black History Month. We'd have menus that reflected what people thought black people ate, red velvet cake, fried chicken, catfish. We would change the veneer of the organization. I always refer to that as floppy disk diversity. In other words, you'd have pictures of black people on easels. You'd have artwork by black people on easels. At 4:30 on February 27th and 28th, they would take all that down. And what was left was the hard drive of what the organization valued. That was a blonde girl with a horse in a dewy setting. There was a very officious-looking white man with a powdered wig. They're riding steeds and horses. They're fox hunting and all that. That is what black people in organization walk into. They don't see anything that reflects their existence or their presence. All we see is what the organization sees itself as. A dewy-eyed white girl with a horse, guys fox hunting and all that. And so I said, okay, so if we're going to change this organization, we have to look at facets of the organization that we ignore, that we walk past every day, but those things do influence us.
Yes, the visual arts. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you don't see yourself. You know, it's like I went to the National Museum in Washington, D.C. Some beautiful art there, but it's all European art. You know, they have specials. They have a special exhibit for black
exhibit.
People.
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But exhibit. It's not. It doesn't go to the core value of who you are.
Well,
so what
the
I
lack
started
of permanence. Yes, it's the, yeah. The lack of permanence is there. Yeah.
That's the way to put it. So what I did was start saying, okay, because I had some influence on the artwork we bought. So I started buying different artwork. Now, you know, if I couldn't get certain black artwork, I went through abstract work, okay? Because everybody then is on the same basis if it's
mm-hmm.
abstract work.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
it is important to understand. I'll give you another example. It's a form of art. Commercials. When I was recruiting for Oscar Mayer, I remember being in Atlanta, and I'm recruiting this very sharp young man, a young black man. And I said, you know, you're really impressive. I'd like to invite you back for an interview at our corporate offices. The kids call it the flyback. If you get a flyback, that means you really made an impression on the interviewer.
Yeah.
And so the young
like
man
call,
said, no, I don't
it's
think.
It's like a callback in our business. It's like a callback. Mm-hmm.
Right. And he said, I'll be honest with you. He said, I just wanted to get a sense of how effective I was as an interviewee. But I couldn't go to Oscar Mayer. I said, why couldn't you go? He said, well, my mother would not be happy. I said, why wouldn't your mother be happy? He said, because all these years she's never seen a black person in an Oscar Mayer commercial. It's always a little white blonde boy pulling a wagon, either as a person or as a cartoon character. And then I realized that's art.
Yes,
and
yes it
art,
is.
This art is sending a message
mm-hmm.
to a community. You don't exist.
Exactly. Exactly.
You don't
how
exist.
Important it is. Mm-hmm. How important that impact is. Yes.
Right. So when you're talking about, and that's why I went back and I looked at every aspect of the organization, the business model, if you will. And I said, we have to look at every aspect of this business model because each aspect conspires to either help you get something done or conspires against you getting something done.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, mm-hmm. recruiting talent, black talent, people of color talent, it wasn't working for me because the organization was not giving me supportive images that I could work with. And see, people don't even talk about it. And it's when this young man said it to me, I thought, oh, my God. Nobody has ever said it like that. But it was a challenge recruiting people because they had the image of this company in Madison, Wisconsin, being an all-white company. And do I want to go in and be the pioneer? No, I don't want to do that.
Yes.
So what I had to do was start changing the way commercials were shot. I'll give you an example. I may have told you this once before. They came to me and they had a storyboard where they were going to do a commercial on Oscar Mayer bacon. And it's going to be a black family. And this black family was in like a million, $2 million house and a beautiful set. And on the storyboard, the father says, what that I smell? What that I smell? And the wife says, this is a storyboard. That's Oscar Mayer bacon. Well, that sure smell good. So they brought it to me and they said, what do you think about this commercial? I said, no. I said, you're turning them into the Beverly Hillbillies. You're giving them
that at all, if that at all. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And
the
he said,
go ahead, because I do want to talk about that. I want to conversate about that. But go ahead. I want you to finish that story. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go.
The guy who was the senior vice president for the division said, well, you know, we checked with another black guy, and he said it was okay. And I said, no, it's not okay. And I went to the other black guy. I said, why'd you do that? He said, you know how they are, you know. They're just trying to trap me. I said, no. They're asking you for your opinion.
Yes, yes, yeah.
He said, well, it's no big deal.
I don't think that people understand, Kwame, the importance of imagery and that that's an art form. And
it's
how that influences, you know, that influences what we think about ourselves and what other people think about us. So to place a family in that environment, but to have the dialect that you put in their mouth make them seem like they're on a plantation with no education and no reason why they got there, except for something, maybe they discovered some oil like the Beverly Hillbillies.
But people don't go that far.
People don't go far enough
to analyze that. What they do is they just think, oh, yeah, that's the way black people talk.
Yes.
So if you talk like that.
Again, the art is a way to educate people. We were talking about this. We just talked about this, the group in Chicago that has contacted me, and you're going to look into it, called Educare Chicago. And how it's an organization of early childhood education, how you make children see themselves and how people see those children is very, very important. And it's very important to start at the very beginning because of the simple fact that it's very hard to unlearn something. If you've ever learned something and then had to unlearn it, it's a difficult thing. And what people always think that art is dispensable. It's one of those things where when the budgets are made, it's the first thing that goes, and they don't realize the influence that we have of who we are as a people in this country. Black, white, brown, yellow is influenced by those imageries. And so the reason why I want you to come in is I want people to understand how important art does influence the corporate structure. I think people only think that...
Well, let me show you how it influences societal thinking. Right after the end of slavery as an institution, Jim Crow took over. And you can go and collect these things, the images that they made of black people.
They created, yes, exactly. They were created images. They weren't images of people, but they decided that this would justify what the level that they wanted to create that those people would have. Now, I'm going to be time conscious here. We're coming up to about only 20 minutes left. So I want to make sure that anyone who is hearing us, who may have potentially a question, gets their question in, because I know that it's going to take more than 30 seconds for you to probably answer it. So I'm starting now a little early so that people, you know, can call in and ask you now. But I want you to continue on. I want to know how you went from the Afro-American Center in the University of Wisconsin. What thought process did you take with you to Oscar Mayer and Kraft Foods? Carl talked about you two were a team back there. I'll just put it like that in the University of Wisconsin.
No, I trusted him.
Yes.
My primary criteria is if you're authentic. You can be wrong. Just be authentic. Mm-hmm. Don't play the game. I don't like trying to peel back what you really mean. Just tell me what you really mean. And Carl is a very direct and honest person. He's authentic.
Yes, he is. He's very particular. You are his best friend, and people who know Carl knows that he's very particular, so that says something right then.
Yeah.
And he talks about, I don't know if it was your group specifically, but the ability for the university to bring people there. I know you all had Angela Davis was there. Muhammad Ali was there. Wasn't Nina Simone there? And
I brought Nina Simone. I brought Nina Simone. I brought Roberta Flack. I brought Pharoah Sanders. I brought the play Your Arms Too Short, The Box with God. I tried to bring culture, our culture, into the mainstream culture.
And tell people and what the population was there, though. What was the ratio of population there?
At UW-Madison?
Yes.
There were like 40-some thousand students, and there's probably like 400 black students.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, isn't that the place, wasn't Otis Redding coming to you all when he met his fate?
Well, he was coming to Madison to perform.
Oh, okay. But not to you all necessarily. Okay.
No.
Okay.
The ones I brought in, like I said, I brought in Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, Angela Davis. I just wanted people to be exposed to more than the images that they had of black people. And so these people were not only artists, they were activists. And so, you know, I wanted to make sure they saw that. And for example, during one of the Black History Months, I brought the Black Ensemble Theater to Kraft.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I paid them as though it was a sold-out show just for Kraft. It was expensive, but it was worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I've always looked at art as being the thing that motivates, inspires, and encourages you. And so it's very hard to separate ourselves from art. It's like, I've always used this phrase, a fish is last to be aware of the presence of water. We're last to be aware of the presence of the arts, but the arts are all around us. And
exactly.
You can see today what's happening. As the quality of the arts degrades, the images become more important. So the rapper's personal life is more important than his production. You know, the illusion is that we're watching their lives, who they're fighting, who they're having sex with, who they're abusing. We've lost sight of the fact that art is to inform and to uplift, not to depress and degrade. And
exactly.
Even some people say that's art, but to me, it may be a variant of art, but it is not true art.
Exactly.
Hey, there's an old saying we use as corporate leaders. Management and leadership is equal parts art and equal parts science. The art of management is how you deal with people. The science is the steps and the procedures you take. But the most effective art, the most effective person is the person who understands the art of management, not the science. It's the art of management. We say that. Okay?
Now, I want to take you to another level of your life, and that is when you were writing your books. How did your love of the arts figure into the and I've got two, but I think you've got more. But at least this one specific that I'm always curious about is black over white being the boss. How did your imagery and art work? How did you do that? The discipline? Just explain to me a little bit how that came to being.
Well, I'll give you an example. The inspiration for the book was my experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought you could tell a group, your new boss is coming, and you could show them the picture of a black person. And automatically, they began to assume a certain posture about how we're going to deal with this. Because you, as the black boss, you're the outlier. You weren't supposed to make it. How do we deal with you? But what they fall back on is systemic racism. We don't have to deal with you. The system will deal with you. But, you know, I'll give you an example. As a black boss, this is a real example. One of my proteges became a vice president, and he was giving an evaluation to a white woman, and she started crying. And she went to the senior HR person and said, he intimidated me. And the senior person, who was a woman, a white woman, suspended him with pay for 2 weeks while they investigated it. And I said, wait a minute. He's giving her an evaluation. You're telling her that this black man who's a VP does not have the authority to talk to you in a certain way. He can't give you feedback unless it's stroking you.
Gently said, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I said, this is sad. This undermines the whole relationship between the boss and the employee, because now you're saying that there are certain aspects of your power that you cannot use if you're a black boss. And there are a lot of black bosses who tread water and walk very carefully not to offend their white subordinates, because they know that the white subordinate can still call on the power and the clout of systemic racism to put that black person in their place. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I start writing the book, and I go back to the old African tradition, which is art, the griot, the oral tradition.
Yes.
And so all I did was take what I would tell you if we were having conversations, and I wrote it down. And I said, here's what you should expect. Here are the things that you need to prepare yourself for. The one point I made is that, you know, as I looked at a lot of our people being promoted and getting into these positions, the one thing I noticed is that they gained weight. You know, it was like,
yes.
No, and their health, they didn't pay any attention. It's like Mao Zedong in China one time outlawed insignias on uniforms, and so everybody had the same uniform. So whether you're a general or whether you're a private. But Mao Zedong came out to review the troops once, and he said, I still know who the general is. It's
mm-hmm.
the fat one.
It's the fat one. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I just started writing this book in a way that says, and my writing is lyrical. You know, I like writing like I'm writing a musical composition. My sentences are short, long. I have a rhythm to my writing. So I use art in writing. Okay, so there's a rhythm to my writing. So
your eyes need the rest of the front.
Yeah.
What you do is you do storytelling in your books and your books and in your nonfiction writing. Yes.
Okay. But that's the musical composition mentality I have. I'm a composer. So I got that from the arts. I got that from the musical arts. I'm
mm-hmm.
a composer.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so when I write my piece, the piece lives on its own. I can't go and explain to you what I meant here, or you should take this up or this note down. Once it's out there, it's out there. So a great musical composition lives its own life, independent of the creator. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, all my life again, it's been the arts, whether they're audio, you know, growing up in the 60s and the 70s, and you're listening to this music and it's pumping you up, people get ready. You think about the groups that were out there. There were a lot of groups that were just really reminding us that we are in a struggle. And the music was so beautiful, but it was still the classic, I think, the definitive album. And I always refer to this album as the first Christian rock album that black people liked. It's Marvin Gaye, What's Going On?
What's Going On? Now, I have to ask you, you're
mm-hmm.
in University Concordia, and you're teaching MBAs?
Yes, I was,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
What did you want them to know about corporate America, what about business? You're talking education, business.
I told them that corporations are microcosms of society. Everything you have in society, you have in corporations. The corporations is not a refuge from society. It's an extension of society.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing I tell them is that the first thing you have to do is be authentic. If you don't know who you are, how can you sell to people an idea or an initiative? You have to be authentic. You have to be transparent. You have to be honest. All the other stuff, the technical stuff, we can work on. But I tell you, if you have a character flaw, it's like having a little ping in your windshield. It doesn't correct itself. It gets bigger. So what for me, the key is find out who you are. Get in touch with your soul, with your internal rhythm. Do that first. The technical stuff I can teach you. But as one of my bosses says, you can't put in what God left out. So if you are a slickster, if you are a hustler, and you can go so far, but eventually you'll be exposed, especially in corporate America. Because the one thing that will cause you to derail your career in corporate America is a loss of trust. If people don't think you are honest or authentic, they will never, ever believe you. They will work with you, but they'll never believe you because you've lost trust. So, again, my message has always been, like the songs, be pure, be authentic. You know, the best performers in any art form, the one common thread that the best performers have is sincerity. You listen to any great singer, what sets them apart from everybody else is how sincere that rendition of what they're doing is. Is it just because as a singer and a great singer like you, you know this? You could just mimic the thing. You don't have to go deep, but in order to really the audience, you have to feel it. You have to be sincere about every lyric, every word, every breath you take. Let me ask you:
do you think that the discipline that is applied to those of us who are performing artists, whether we are directing, performing, visual, you know, that our disciplines are as challenging as the disciplines given to business majors, given to medical majors? I always wind up defending the training that we have and how we apply that in life, in that people always think that what we do for a living is not work. However, the business part of it is more work. Can you, knowing in your life, you have people in your life who are artists, who are performing artists, can you relate to them being as disciplined as you were when you were training to do all the things that you have done?
It's more discipline. I've watched my daughter, who's an actress and a singer, Lauren. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've been with her. I've listened to her at home. It's a constant process of improvement. The artist is not competing with another artist. They're competing with themselves. They're trying to get the best out of themselves. They're like swimmers. They don't compete necessarily against the competition. They compete against their worst time. They want to improve their time. So every day, artists cannot take a day off, And the training is rigorous. People don't realize that, because what happens is that you have to come on stage and it has to appear spontaneous. And I always used to tell my staff, like an artist, spontaneity looks best when it's planned and rehearsed.
Yes, I do know that very well. You make it seem very, very easy, so everybody says, oh, I can do that.
Right, until they give you a microphone and you sound like a frog croaking, then you realize, I can't do that. It's important to understand that the artist is totally dedicated to their profession. It's an example I used to use when I was younger. I would say that you think about breakfast and the breakfast meat. The chicken makes a contribution to the breakfast. The hog makes a total commitment.
All right. With that said, we have less than 10 minutes left in this program. See,
all right.
I told you how fast it goes.
Yes, you did.
Once you start really talking about things that are influenced by artistry, you realize how many facets of your life the arts have really touched. And, you know, one of the things that I'm always fascinated by is, first of all, your memory, because you have a memory, I think, that is photographic, because when you read, you can remember quotes and quote.
Yes.
You quote me all the time, you know.
Right.
One of the things that, and I just want to bring it up in these last few minutes. If we don't, people are still listening. Their callers are here. You know, the board is now full of callers, but nobody's asking any questions right now because they're listening. Sure. Recently, when we talked about this whole thing in Silicon Valley and the people who are now coming out talking about the lack of diversity, especially in the theater, the Apple Theater, and there are a couple of people in my world who have gone and been recruited to the Apple Theater. Do you think, and we're only, I mean, this is now just us lay people tossing around a thought and in conversation. Do you think recruiting a lot of people from the theater is just a cosmetic effort in order to give the impression of diversity? Is that why people are coming out now talking about how they have to sign a paper that they can't talk about the diversity in their companies? What do you think about all of those kinds of things?
Well, I think we have been mucking around with and tinkering with and avoiding the total commitment to diversity. And we've found ways, organizations have found ways to placate people, just to calm them down. Not to say we're going to commit to anything, but to say, look, we have activities, but those activities are disparate and they're not connected and they're not strategic. So it's just activities. It's like If you are a martial artist, you can learn the physical aspects of the martial arts, but until you learn the thought process, the zen behind martial arts, you're just a puppet. You're just showing moves, physical moves. And so Diversity is that same thing. You know, this thing has been going on for 50 years. Any other corporate initiative that took 50 years, heads would roll. But instead, people get promoted. You know, it's like, yeah, we couldn't do it. We couldn't find anybody. Well, you know, I don't know if the company's ready for this. And I always pointed out to them that, look, there are three imperatives to diversity. There's the moral imperative. Some of us walk into a room and say, you know, this ain't right. This is not right. There are no people of color here. And There are white employees who go to work every day and they never look around and go, this ain't right. But we walk in and go, this ain't right. So one of the things we have to have people understand is that the diversity is really not just a programmatic initiative. This is a major culture shift, moving from a culture that has bias going in one direction, and that is to white people and not to us. And what we're saying is, look, bias always exists. Now reverse the bias, okay? We learned affirmative action from white people because they based their selection and placement on whether you were white or not. And if you were not white, you remember the old thing we used to say on the playground? If you're brown, stick around. If you're yellow, you're a mellow fellow. If you're black, stay back.
Well, now I have someone who has a question. I'm going to let them in and see if we have enough time. Hold on here. Identify yourself, please, and let me and say your question. There you go. Hello.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I'm calling from Houston. I'm curious, working in the corporate world, if, let's just say Oscar Mayer, did they give corporate donations to any arts organizations or theaters?
Oh, yeah. Yes, they did. In fact, when I was chairman of the contribution committee, I made sure my alma mater, my undergraduate school, they were building a theater, and I made sure they got $40,000 and, you know, to buy a seat or some seats, label Oscar Mayer. So we always did. But a lot of it was based on who the executives knew. So the general population of employees couldn't really give to their organizations because most of the money had already been earmarked by the executives who sit on boards of theaters or in artwork museums and things like that. But yes, we did. We did contribute to the arts. Mm-hmm. And corporations.
No, go ahead. Corporations.
Well, and corporations typically do. When we were owned by Philip Morris, I remember going to 120 Park Avenue, and they had one of the most impressive art collections in the corridors. Just really, just outstanding. And I know corporations pride themselves, especially corporate business people. They want to be cultured. They go to the opera. They go to plays. They want to be cultured because, you see, what we're dealing with is just selling commodities. I mean, it's not a sexy business. Most corporations aren't sexy business. They're selling, meat, bread, tools. It's not sexy. And so in order to make yourself feel like you're successful, the only way you can do that is be familiar with or cognizant of the arts. And that's what you do. You wrap yourself in the arts, which says that you are sophisticated. You're finished product. So the arts are important. The arts are important in life because, you know, the people that we really admire are the artists. And
yep.
What we don't understand is what the artist goes through to create their product. But all we want is the product. We just buy the product. And it's almost like the product created itself. It's like Pablo Picasso once, and he was criticized for selling a painting for an exorbitant amount of money. And somebody said to him, a critic said, well, it only took you 2 hours to draw it. He said, yeah, it took me a lifetime to conceive it.
There you go. Now, before I thank you, Michelle. Before we get ready to go, because we only have 2 minutes left, I do want to mention the fact that you have a scholarship at Whitewater, don't you, under the name of your parents?
Yes, I set up a scholarship under the name of my parents.
Yes.
For anybody going into education, teaching young kids who are underprivileged and marginalized, if you go in and teach in one of those schools, you get money from our scholarship.
Excellent. I set it up
after my father died, and my mother was alive, so she saw it. But yeah, I felt I needed to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to continue this conversation with you on the after show afterthoughts because we're now down to almost the last a minute and a half. And
okay.
And I have to, prepare the audience for our guest next week, which is the female conductor of Beauty that I work with. Her name is Vicky Carter. And she will be here next week. One more question. One of the callers wants to know: did you read Cast, the book by Isabel Wilkerson? Have you read that yet?
Not yet, but I read her first book. We have it. I read
yes.
Warmth of the Other Sun.
Yes.
You know, and
yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
You know where she got the title from, right?
No, but we're going to find out. In the after show,
okay.
Because we're getting
right.
ready to go. Okay.
Okay. All right.
I told you. All right.
All right.
We're getting ready to go. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. You look at Godly Entertainment or YouTube for the continuation of this in our after show afterthoughts. And thank you again for tuning in, Lenny Godfrey, Straight No Chaser. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you, Kwame, and we'll be talking in a few minutes.
Thank you.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight,
fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word